It's like a nice day out there today and to enjoy the last.
Well, good morning and thanks for tuning in. Today is Wednesday, September 19th, and you're listening to The Morning Show here at 88.5 KRFY. And I'm Susie Prez, along with my co-host this morning, Jean Girth. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning, Susie. Before we get to our Water is Life presentation for week four, let's hear the weather from the National Weather Service.
I think that's a good idea. And if you went out to your car this morning early and you were scraping, what is that called, frost off the windows? Well, it makes sense because at 5:35, the temperature in Sandpoint was 32 degrees. So we did have a frost last night in Sandpoint, even though the Weather Service set a low of 41. And
that gets the gardeners scrambling, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
A little technical.
There we go. We're back on. We're recording this for our podcast. But from the National Weather Service, 36 degrees. Currently, today we can expect, what can we expect over here? Patchy fog and then partly sunny, a high of 68. So another one of those really nice, warm fall days, almost fall. Low tonight, 44, clear skies. Tomorrow, 40% chance of showers with a high of 62. And tomorrow night, that's Thursday night, 20% chance of showers and a low of 43. So there you go. It kind of goes on. Friday night, we have 50% chance of showers. Through the weekend, a chance of showers.
It's fall.
There you go.
So this is the final week of our four-part series on water called Water is Life. We started the series in week one, interviewing a healthcare provider about the importance of water to our health, and then we did another interview with the City of Sandpoint personnel on how water is treated, tested, and delivered to city residents.
And in week two, we brought in experts on the Ice Age flood who told us how our lake was formed. A second interview was with meteorologists from out of Spokane who explained how weather replenishes the water and how the seasonal precipitation patterns impact us. Week three focused on water use in our region and the importance of state water use regulations and policies.
Today, in our fourth and final presentation, we wanted our interviews for this segment to address the question, how do we protect our water? Two organizations that have been important players in that task are Lake Ponderay Water Keepers, a nonprofit who works in the public interest to minimize pollution in Lake Ponderay and related water bodies, and another organization, the Tri-State Water Quality Council, which set up long-term water agreements that were mandated by the Clean Water Act for our lake.
But before we get to that interview, we have some fun facts that we've been doing all along. And Jean, did you know? I wanted to take a look at water around the world, and this may be a repeat from the first week, but it's significant. Some 1.8 billion people worldwide drink water that is contaminated. 2.5 billion people do not have the use of an improved sanitation facilities. And 748 million people in the world do not have access to a clean source of drinking water. So that's around the world. And just a little bit of information about the Flint water crisis. This is from Wikipedia. And in April of 2014, in Flint, Michigan, population of over 100,000 people, the drinking water source for the city of Flint was changed from Lake Huron to Detroit Witt River, and it caused the lead in the pipes to leach into the drinking water. 6 to 12,000 children were contaminated with lead. These are pretty significant bits of information. And what we're trying to show here is, first of all, that we have such great water here. But in regards to that, for over 3 years, the folks in Flint, Michigan, 100,000 people had to use bottled water. And the question becomes, and I think you have some of the answers, Jean, is bottled water better? And, you know, the use of that much bottled water over that period of time is heavy pollution of plastics. But is bottled water safer and is it better?
And clearly, in some circumstances, it is. And when you have to use it, you have to use it. But here are some things for people who have the option about whether to use bottled water or tap water. Tap water is tested more often and held to higher safety standards than bottled water in the United States. There are 30 million bottles per day end up in landfills or in the ocean. Only 5% of plastic water bottles are recycled in the U.S. So there's good reason to pause when you are looking at bottled water. And I've been an advocate of tap water for a long time, but when I went to Ethiopia, I drank bottled water. There was no choice.
And so, you know, part of this reason we did this series was to take a look at our water here, but a little bit about, in comparison to the rest of the world, we have amazing water. So let's get to our first interview. This was recorded earlier in the week. It is with Dr. Shannon Williamson from the Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeepers. And
Susie's lining up the interview. So Shannon is the executive director of the Waterkeeper. They do quite a few projects, and we'll let her tell you about them.
And here we go. We'll be back after this interview. Thank you, Shannon, executive director of Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper, for joining the conversation, Water is Life. As the waterkeeper of Lake Pend'Oreille, what is your background and experience that supports the work you do?
Great question, and thanks for having me on today. I have a background in marine science. I have a PhD in biological oceanography, and so I spent most of my professional career in the saltwater environment until I moved up to North Idaho. But I found that my background and training in marine science and specifically microbiology has really served me well here on Lake Pend'Oreille.
So tell us how Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper came about here in this watershed.
Okay. The organization was founded in 2009. That's when we became an official waterkeeper organization. And I'll go into kind of what instigated the formation of our organization, but real quickly, I'll just say a few words about what Waterkeeper is. And so we are a member of what's called the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is a global organization that consists of now, I believe, over 350 individual member organizations that are waterkeepers across the globe. And so there's lake keepers, sound keepers, bay keepers, river keepers, so any water body that you can think of. The goal of the Waterkeeper Alliance is to put some type of waterkeeper on that water body. And we all work in a similar fashion to ensure that our waterways are swimmable, fishable, and drinkable. So that's what we do here at Waterkeeper, Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper.
And I'm trying to remember my history. I grew up on the East Coast. Did this start for the Hudson River?
It did. It did. Started almost 20 years ago now. And that water body was incredibly polluted, literally on fire. Came to the attention that it needed some really special care. And so that's what folks are doing all around the globe now, including us here.
And it's been very effective.
I'd like to think so. We're really fortunate here in Lake Pend'Oreille region that while most waterkeepers, or many of them, are working to restore really horribly polluted waterways back to their more natural state, we're working to prevent that from happening in the first place, which has tons of benefits, but also lots of challenges as well.
To get a little bit better picture, could you describe the area of protection you serve as the waterkeeper of Lake Pend'Oreille? What does it mean to protect the water quality of Lake Pend'Oreille and its associated waters? And what are the associated waters?
Sure. So as a waterkeeper and as a member of the Alliance, we had to define what's called a jurisdiction. And so our jurisdiction of care is quite large. It's 125,000 surface acres of water. It begins at the Cabinet Gorge Dam on the Clark Fork River, goes down the Clark Fork River throughout the lake, and then ends about 20 miles down the Pend'Oreille River at the Albany Falls Dam. And that also includes all of the other tributaries that come into the lake. And so it's quite a large area. And really what it means to protect water quality is to keep all of those waters swimmable, fishable, and drinkable. When you have good water quality, you can do all of those things. And when you have bad water quality, you can't. And so water quality really is just an indicator to us of watershed health.
And you've already said that we're in better shape than some of the waterkeeper areas. Is that true? That's true nationwide? Is that true globally, too? Do you have a sense of just how special our water is?
Sure. I mean, I'd definitely say in comparison to the developing world and developing nations, you know, the water quality here is excellent. We just have policies and procedures and infrastructure in place that is more protective of our water bodies here than in developing countries. And so they face a lot of really unique challenges that we don't necessarily face here. And I'd say in contrast to other water bodies around the United States, we're incredibly blessed to have such a near pristine waterway to enjoy every single day. But that also puts us in a really unique, challenging position to keep it that way, because there are threats and they're not going to go away. And so it's really up to us to make sure that we keep this waterway as beautiful as it is.
And sometimes people don't appreciate that until it goes away.
So absolutely.
It is, I think, harder to highlight that in an area that is in good shape.
Absolutely. That is probably our number one challenge.
You talked about water quality and making sure that that happens. How are the many different ways? So in your day-to-day job as the waterkeeper, there's probably many different ways that you monitor and protect Lake Ponderay. What does the information that you gather through the monitoring process give you that helps you get a better understanding of how to protect this water source?
Sure. So we have a great citizen science-run water quality monitoring program that's now in its seventh season, and we monitor with the help of all of our volunteers 15 locations around Lake Ponderay and the Ponderay River. And as I mentioned, we've been doing this since 2012, and now we're starting to get a pretty nice picture of what our water quality is looking like over time. And it really speaks to the fact that we do have a near pristine water body. Most of the sites that we monitor are in great shape. We can see, you know, changes that happen between June and October, which is our monitoring season, which we now can determine if that's a normal fluctuation or if there's something that's changing more rapidly. However, we have identified areas that are under distinct threats from nutrient pollution. And we've been able to use that data we've collected, share it with our regulatory agencies at the state level that confirmed our observations, and then actually have done something about it. So one particular area of the lake has been listed on the list of impaired waterways for Idaho, which means that over the next few years, the state agency needs to develop what's called a total maximum daily load, which will help protect and restore that particular area of the lake. So we're really pleased that the information that we've been able to collect is actually producing meaningful results in the protection of the lake.
What area is that?
It's a little backwater area called Boyer Slough off of Whiskey Jack Road. It's a beautiful area back in there. Doesn't get flushed very well. It is the receiving waters for a sewage treatment plant. There's also a lot of input from the surrounding agricultural lands. And so it's just a nutrient-stressed environment that just needs some special attention.
When you say that this area has been identified and you sent this information to state agencies, mm-hmm. then it's their responsibility then to not maybe mitigate the situation, but to change that direction that it was going. Mm-hmm. And does Waterkeeper follow up on that?
Yes, absolutely. We were thrilled, you know, that the Department of Environmental Quality took action. It's really important for these impaired areas to be officially listed on what's called a 303D list, on a report that comes out every 2 years. And once that a water body is listed as impaired, there needs to be action to restore it. But that can be a long process. It can take an inordinate amount of time. And so we try to, you know, support the agency any way that we can in making sure that that process is carried out.
And I wanted to mention, too, that Lake Ponderay Waterkeepers is a nonprofit and it's a membership organization.
Yes.
And people can join, and it's really important work to support. You have a website, and I'm sure people can go to that. And
We do. It's www.lpow.org, and there's a Get Involved tab. You can learn how to become a member. It's not expensive. You can also learn how to become a volunteer if that's something that interests you.
We learned in week two of this series on Water is Life that the Ice Age flood of Lake Missoula helped to form the Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer, which serves almost 1 million people between Coeur d'Alene Post Falls and Spokane. So the Lake Ponderay feeds into this aquifer. This broadens our scope quite a bit. What happens in Lake Ponderay is actually influences a pretty big population base. So what can we do as citizens to protect this water?
Okay, I think that it really comes down to, I think, personal awareness. Like when we ask ourselves, what can we do? It's really our everyday actions that are going to cumulatively impact the integrity of this water body. And so really kind of being aware of what we do on a daily basis, how we treat our property, learning about issues that impact the water quality. Sometimes they might seem overwhelming, so you can take charge of your own actions and make sure you're minimizing your impact or imprint on the water, but also getting involved in some of the larger issues that might seem overwhelming, things like wastewater and stormwater and the transport of hazardous materials through the watershed. These are all big issues, but we've seen personally how successful individual action can be when people get together and join forces. And so it can become a very, very powerful movement. And so if that's something that people are interested in learning about more or some of the larger threats to the watershed, they can certainly do that by talking personally with me or checking out our website. But we often have opportunities to get involved, and by going to our website, they can learn about those.
So those big issues that we need to address as a group, can you give us an example of just one thing an individual could do just about on their property? There's a lot of lakefront properties.
Absolutely.
And I assume you have information about that too at the website?
Yes. Yeah, so if you are fortunate to be a lakefront or waterfront property owner, there's lots of things you can do to minimize your impact. One of them is make sure you have a nice buffer between your property and the waterfront, so with native plants and shrubs that can go a very long way in filtering, providing a natural filtration system for nutrients that are coming off your land. So if you enjoy your green lawn and wish to fertilize, then that really helps minimize that fertilizer getting into the water, which has a pretty significant impact on the growth of aquatic plants that most people don't really care for to be around their docks. So that's one really powerful way. Also being aware of other types of chemicals you might be putting onto your lawn, all of these things get into the water, and doing really simple things like rain gardens or capturing water that's coming off your roof or your driveway and preventing some of that from getting into the water can help keep some of those compounds out that we don't want in there.
We've talked about some of the threats, such as fertilizer from lawns and things like that, but there's some really bigger threats, and you kind of alluded to a potential train derailment that could put heavy pollutants into the water. And these are potentials out there, but nonetheless would be devastating. So we're not in, it sounds like we don't want to put Lake Ponderay in a position like the Hudson River was, where it was a gigantic cleanup site, but to keep it clean in the first place. What are some of those other potential threats? And it could be the train derailment, something like that. And what can be done to take care of them before they happen?
Right. So you mentioned, this is a railroad town, and we have about 50 or 60 trains coming through town and basically over the lake and adjacent to the lake every single day. And a proportion of those trains carry hazardous materials that we want to make sure remain inside the train cars and out of our lake. And so really kind of being aware of expansion efforts and what we can do to really request that, the utmost safety and care and concern is paid attention to in the transport of those materials, whether it's the integrity of the tracks, the rail cars, things like that. And so, that's a huge project and effort, and there's opportunities for public involvement there, and I really encourage everybody to stay involved with that particular issue. As for some of the other more pressing issues, I'd really say that they have to do mostly with what we call over-nutrification of the water body. And so nutrients get into our waters in a lot of different ways. We all need nutrients. Plants need nutrients to grow. for sure. But when you have too much, that's when we start to get a bit of a mess. And we hear a lot now about people recreating on our waterways, waterfront property owners really frustrated with overgrowth of plants. Most of them are actually native. And that comes from too much candy getting into the water for the plants. And that comes from areas like wastewater. It comes from areas like stormwater, which as a small community, our stormwater is completely unregulated. We don't know what's in it. And that's where it really comes back to your own personal actions and awareness of trying to minimize your contribution to some of this nutrient compounds getting into the water. If you're a private property owner and you have a septic system, making sure that, you know, that is in good health, that leaking septic systems contribute quite a bit to overgrowth of plants from those nutrients. And we're hearing more and more of how these smaller, more shallow lakes that are all around us are starting to have more frequent blooms of toxic algae. We are not immune to that. We have those species in our lake. They're naturally occurring. And when they reach critical mass, it's because of that influx of nutrients. And so we need to be able to really keep a close eye on that so that we don't become another story where we have health advisories being listed.
When we talk about regulations and things like that, and you're talking about getting involved, how can people get involved? And we alluded to your website. Do you mm-hmm. have information that's kind of current updates of maybe public mm-hmm. notices or public meetings that they can go and get informed and or make a statement?
Yes. And so if you go on our website, you can sign up for our e-newsletter, which is a great way to stay informed. Also, when we do have specific action items, that will be posted on our homepage. And so many times when there's big decision-making processes, whether it be for the railroad, whether it's for a sewage treatment plan, what have you, that involves public comment, these are often phased opportunities that happen between certain timelines. And so we try to make people aware of when those windows of opportunity are and make it as easy as possible for people to contribute their comments and concerns by providing guidance on what these agencies are really looking for, because different agencies regulate different things, and it can get complicated. And so we try our best to say, you know, this is what this agency is looking at regulating, this X, Y, or Z. And these are the things that they want to know about that would impact their decision-making process. So we try to make it as straightforward as possible. And really, it's liking us on Facebook or signing up for our e-newsletter is an excellent way to stay informed.
And that website again is
www.lpow.org.
You mentioned that stormwater is not regulated at mm-hmm. all. So that makes me think that this question, I know the answer to this question, do you think that current federal and state regulations are adequate to protect water in this area?
Sure. Well, really, you know, we use the Clean Water Act as our guiding principle in everything that we do, which is a federal regulation. And it's an interesting thing going on in Idaho right now. We were one of very few states up until very recently where the federal government, through the EPA, pretty much regulated all of our discharges into water. So that was wastewater, industrial waste, pesticides, stormwater, anything that was discharging into waters of the United States. And so the EPA regulated that. And a couple of years ago, the Idaho State Legislature mandated that our state take that on through our Department of Environmental Quality, like most states in the nation. And that is happening right now. And the first process that the state has taken over regulating is wastewater. And there will be a phased approach to this. And eventually, they'll be regulating everything, stormwater, and industrial waste, what have you, pesticides, everything. And so we're waiting to see kind of what that's going to look like. We hope that it'll be a more efficient process. You know, it's closer to home, which always makes things, I think, a little bit more efficient than working with, you know, something out there in Washington, D.C. As for some of the regulations or guidelines that are on the books currently in Idaho, I think they're pretty lacking when it comes to protecting water quality. Idaho has, and most states have, what are called water quality standards. And part of those standards are certain criteria or thresholds for substances that can be in the water. And so they say you can only have X amount of Y. So things that have a numeric criteria are things like toxics, things that are very obviously toxic to our bodies or to the bodies of inhabitants of our lakes and rivers. But things like nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, they don't have any numbers associated with them right now. And that's very unusual. So Idaho, we just have what are called narrative criteria. Like, you shouldn't have so much phosphorus in the water that it's going to make things slimy. You know, that's really hard to document and use as a tool for enforcement when there's no number associated with that. And so that's a very long-term goal of Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper and other waterkeepers in Idaho. There's two more of us, whole two more. For us to work towards establishing numeric criteria for some of these other things that don't seem toxic on the surface, but as I just mentioned, have a tremendous impact on the long-term sustainability of our lake. So, you know, I think it's kind of a mixed bag right now, and there's always room for improvement. We're, you know, we're not cheerleaders for over-regulation, but there need to be tools for us as an organization and everybody as a citizen to use to protect their way of life and clean water.
We want to give... Thank you so much, by the way. And we want to give that contact information again. That's L-P-O-W-K?
Just L-P-O-W.
Okay, lpow.org. It's a website. You can sign up for a newsletter that has up-to-the-date information. And I do have to say thank you for being a scientist that is protecting our lake here in North Idaho. And thank you, Shannon Williamson, Executive Director of Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeeper, for joining us in this conversation, Water is Life, and for sharing your expertise and your dedication to this important work of protecting our lake.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're live again here in the KRFY studio, 88.5, and this is The Morning Show. This is week four and the final presentation of the series, Water is Life. We're ready now for our second interview with Diane Williams, who was involved with the originally involved with the Tri-State Water Quality Council. We're here with Diane Williams, a Bonner County resident since 1988. She's been involved in protecting the Clark Fork Pend'Oreille watershed for almost as long. Today, we're asking her about the work and programs of the Tri-State Water Quality Council from 1993 to 2012. Good morning, Diane.
Hello, Jean.
Thanks for joining Susie and me here today.
My pleasure.
How and why, Diane, did the Tri-State Water Quality Council get started?
Well, as a result of citizen concerns about increased aquatic weeds and algae in the Clark Fork River and Lake Pend'Oreille and the Pend'Oreille River, U.S. Congress added language to the 1987 Clean Water Act to enable studies within our entire watershed to study the sources of pollution and to assess the extent and sources and to recommend pollution control measures. The section of the Clean Water Act was called Section 525, and that study was completed, those studies were completed in 1992 by the three states, Idaho, Montana, and Washington, which cover the entire Clark Fork Pend'Oreille watershed.
So this is the Clean Water Act that we've all heard of, right?
Correct,
and
yes.
So why did Lake Pend'Oreille get into that?
There was apparently a lobbying effort that was done with the congressional delegations at the time in all three states. It was a coordinated effort to get appropriation under the Clean Water Act to accomplish these studies. They were getting a lot of concerns from citizens throughout the three states about all the algae growth. I think it was really prevalent in the Clark Fork River is kind of what started it.
Okay. Thanks.
When you're talking about the Tri-State Water Quality Council, who participated in this? Who were some of the council partners, and what geographical area did the council cover?
Well, the council covered the entire Clark Fork Pend'Oreille watershed, and I'm not sure if folks, especially new to the area, understand how large our watershed is. It's 16 million acres, 25,000 square miles, and it covers western Montana, northern Idaho, and eastern Washington. So it starts at the Clark Fork River in Butte, Montana, comes all the way down 200 miles into Lake Pend'Oreille, all the way through Lake Pend'Oreille, and then into the Pend'Oreille River, goes into eastern Washington, and the Pend'Oreille River joins the Columbia River just north of the border into Canada. So it's a huge, one of the largest watersheds in the country. So with all these jurisdictions, so you can imagine, we had 3 states, 14 counties, several Native American reservations, and 2 regions of the EPA. So with all those entities involved in our watershed, the council membership then reflected basically entities from all 3 states throughout the watershed. So we had private industry, local governments, county governments, federal agencies, both regions of the EPA, the 3 states' water quality agencies, and all of the major point source dischargers in the Clark Fork River, as well as in Lake Ponderay. We had the Kalispell Tribe of Indians, some public utility districts. I think that probably much wraps it up.
I'm stunned that you could get all of that.
One difference about the council was that we were not a membership-based organization in terms of we didn't have private citizens as members of the council. We did have some nonprofit organizations such as the Clark Fork Coalition out of Missoula, which kind of represented the general public.
Is the Tri-State Water Quality Council still in existence?
It is not still in existence. We started running into some funding problems, I think, as everybody does along the years. We were around for, 20 years. We had accomplished a lot of the goals that we had set out to do. And, we became a victim of our own organization to a certain extent because of the way we were organized, not being that membership-based organization. And having a lot of government entities on our council, which then became not attractive to, for instance, nonprofit funders and that type of thing. So
what programs did the council initiate that protected water quality in Lake Ponderay and the entire watershed?
Well, we had a number of flagship programs. So the initial Clark Fork Ponderay Basin Management Plan basically had programs concentrating on reducing nutrient pollution in the Clark Fork River, Lake Ponderay, and the Ponderay River. So our huge flagship program in the Clark Fork River was the Voluntary Nutrient Reduction Program.
And I'm going to slow you up just a little bit here because you've talked about point source pollution and you're talking about nutrient pollution. And so those are two different types?
Point source pollution just means there's a entity there's a pipe that's a point source of pollution. So say a wastewater treatment plant that's discharging to the river, that would be a point source of pollution. Nutrient pollution is a type of pollution. So there's point source pollution, and then there's non-point source pollution, which is basically runoff and those types of things that have nothing to do with an actual pipe into the river or the lake that's discharging.
It sounds like the point pollution source is something you can go to. It's an entity and you can work with them and bring regulation. The other nutrient pollution is more difficult to pinpoint and possibly contain.
Well, the point source pollution, point source polluters or pollution point sources can involve nutrients. They could be discharging nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, are the two nutrients that we're talking about. So, for instance, the Voluntary Nutrient Reduction Program in the Clark Fork River brought together the 4 major dischargers of nutrient pollution into the Clark Fork River.
And what were those?
So that was the City of Butte, the City of Deer Lodge, the City of Missoula, and at the time, the Smurfit Stone Container Corporation outside of Missoula. That was a pulp mill that was making cardboard boxes, basically. So we got those 4 dischargers together to voluntarily reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus they were discharging into the Clark Fork River.
And how long did it take to see a difference in the quality of the water once that agreement came about between those 4 point source?
Well, that points to another program that we started, which was our 3-state monitoring program. And the purpose of that program was to monitor the amount of both nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in the Clark Fork and the lake, et cetera, and to monitor the amount of algae growth. So over the course of time, within about probably 8-10 years, we were able to see measurable differences in the amount of actual measured amounts of nutrients that were in the river, as well as measurable amounts of reduction in algae growth.
Is algae growth one of the main ways that you see that nutrients have gone into the river?
Yes, that's a very visual indicator of excessive nutrient pollution. Algae thrive on particularly phosphorus, thrive on that type of growth. And I think eventually you'll see that also with some of the milfoil growth, et cetera. It feeds, you know, it's a nutrient. It's basically a fertilizer.
How did the identified threats in the first management plan in 1993 differ from the threats in the updated management plan that was in 2007? Over time, did these things change?
Well, originally, the original management plan just identified the nutrient pollution. After the course of time, and we kind of were, you know, dealing with that issue, we realized that there were other things happening in the watershed. For instance, you know, we had a lot of urban growth was starting. We had a lot more residential growth going on. And there were other items that were coming to the forefront that people were concerned about. So our second, that was another program of the council, was to update that management plan. And that second management plan, besides nutrients, identified sediment, temperature, meaning higher temperatures in the water, gas supersaturation, and invasive weeds as other threats to water quality. Gas supersaturation is something that we can't directly deal with. That's a result of the dams on the Lower Clark Fork River. When they spill water, it generates gases in the water that affect fish, gas bubble disease, they call it. Temperature, that was mainly in the Pendere River. The excess, you know, just too hot of temperatures, again, mainly for fish. Invasive weeds, I think we all know about milfoil and where that's going. And sediment, you know, again, there's your nutrient pollution and runoff. And sediment's important not only for fish reasons. Up in the tributaries, it can smother fish eggs, that type of thing. But often phosphorus is attached to sediment. And so when you get that sediment runoff, you're also contributing phosphorus into the water column. So those were some of the ways we tried to kind of get more modern with our approach as far as what we were dealing with in the basin here. Other programs that we did do, and they're still in existence, are we did K through 12 education programs. Our main one was the Water Festival, which is still in existence. It's over 20 years old. Which is a great program. The local Bonner Soil and Water Conservation District has taken that program over when the council folded their doors. We also developed nutrient loading targets, what's commonly known as TMDLs in the watershed world, for both for Lake Pendere, a TMDL at the Montana Nutrient at the Montana-Idaho border for nutrients. We had a nutrient load agreement between the states of Idaho and Montana that we facilitated. We worked with the Bonner Soil and Water Conservation District for lake assist programs, did a number of brochures for waterfront property owners covering all kinds of topics from fertilizing and cutting riparian vegetation to boater, boating pollution, that type of thing.
So this was a big increase in the scope of what was addressed, and it sounds like if you're addressing residences and other points of pollution that aren't quite so easy to point your finger at. Is that non-point?
That's non-point. That would be our non-point. You got it. Yeah.
I remembered that term, and I couldn't quite.
Yeah, and it was challenging because, as you know, there's lots of issues out there now, and how to reach everybody and help them understand what's going on and what they can do to contribute or help the problem and be part of the solution is a challenge.
You mentioned that the Tri-State Water Quality Council is no longer in existence. But the work that was being done is essential. The Water Festival stayed to help students understand. I've seen that. It's a beautiful presentation to students. And also, you mentioned Lake Assist has picked up some of it. But who's really holding the picture that Tri-State used to hold?
Well, nobody really. I mean, it's up to the individual state water quality agencies now. We have, you know, the TMDLs and the Nutrient Border Agreement that are in place, those now are between the states. It's up to them to enforce those loading targets, to do the monitoring for those targets, and to make sure, you know, folks are, that there's controls put into any permits that, that people take that incorporate those types of controls.
So some of the regulations and things that Tri-State put into place are still in place, being held by other entities.
Correct. They're being basically monitored and controlled by other entities now.
So it's a standard that is now in place when people go to get permits for a big water project of some sort.
Right.
That's in place now. It sounds like the Tri-State Water Quality Council was essential at the time up until 2012. It was in existence.
It was. And actually, it started out, and I should back up. We started out as being the implementer of that original basin management plan, because we did not exist when that basin management plan happened. We were a result of that basin management plan, because one of the goals of that plan was to set up an entity to implement the priorities and goals of the plan, and that became the Tri-State Council. Originally, we were called the Tri-State Implementation Council, and then we eventually changed our name because nobody knew what that meant.
Overall, do you have an impression of what the lake is like now? Are these things that you worked on so diligently still in place? Is the lake better off? Is it getting worse?
When I left the council in 2012, the lake was better off. And we know that because we conducted a trends analysis that took a look at 20 years of monitoring data and some all the way back to the 1950s when they were doing Secchi disk lake transparency studies in the lake. And based on that, the lake's open lake water quality hasn't changed since the mid-1950s. We saw a tremendous reduction in the amount of nutrients in our near shore areas, which is kind of a problem because you'll see that more in a near shore area. The open lake is just, you know, the beautiful open lake that it is. Personally, you know, I go around a lot. I kayak a lot. I go on the lake a lot. You know, there's just certain bays that may you might still see some of the, you know, algae growth and slime, what they call on the rocks. But in general, I think if you go around and you're on those nearshore areas, I mean, the water is crystal clear. You don't see that slime on the rocks. You don't, you know, you can see every pebble and rock in the lake, and they're clear and clean. And I think that's just something really unique and beautiful about the lake and why we all want to keep it protected.
Are the monitoring programs still in place?
From my understanding, the state of Idaho does still do some monitoring in the lake. I don't know exactly what their program is. I know Avista has continued some of the monitoring up near their reservoirs on the Clark Fork River, Cabin and Gorge and Noxon Dams. They were contributors to our monitoring program, and they were also on the Tri-State Council.
This is very riveting and interesting. One of the things that also is interesting when you think about what you put together in 1993 is that coalition of all those groups. That's pretty unique, and how they all work together to set up something that would go into the future and be taken care of by each of the states.
Yeah, that's a very really unique thing that happened here in our watershed. Eventually, you'll see a lot more of these collaborations that happened across the country here and there. But the council was kind of at the forefront of that movement, so to speak. And I think part of the success of it is because we were not, you know, while we advocated for water quality, it wasn't in the traditional sense of some of the nonprofit groups. We weren't adversarial. We weren't involved in lawsuits. It was all done out of mutual respect, collaboration. Let's all work towards the goal. And there really was a tremendous amount of mutual respect within the council. We had, you know, ground rules, how to deal with each other, and everybody was so respectful. And I always talk about my own personal experience of, like, I never thought I would sit down with the, you know, manager of the, you know, Smurfit Stone Container Corporation and think in a million years that I would have anything in common with the man. But I did. And, you know, that was the kind of the nature and the culture of the Tri-State Council. So it was a really great, great organization.
It sounds like a process that would be very useful in many things today, that kind of collaboration.
Yeah, I think people could take some lessons from learning how to be respectful and get along and focus on goals and priorities.
Well, Diane, thank you for the work you did with the Tri-State Water Quality Council. That's beautiful work. It's very important. You helped our quality of life here and our Lake Pendere. So thank you. And thanks for coming in and joining with us in this conversation called Water is Life.
Thank you. It was very, very nice to be here. I appreciate it.
And we're back live at 88.5 KRFY. And thanks for listening to our Water is Life series. This four-part series is available on our website as a podcast. You can go to krfy.org under podcast and recorded podcast page. The whole four-week series is available there. And again, thank you for listening.
And I want to thank you, Susie, for bringing me into the studio. This was really my first official broadcast experience. And thinking back on this series, I wanted to ask you, how does this compare with your original idea? And how did you come up with this idea?
Well, it far exceeds, you know, my co-host for the regular Wednesday morning show, Chris Bessler, was going to be gone for 4 weeks. And I thought, I want to do something different. We have other morning shows where we can put community organizations on. Let's do something different. And you and I were on our way to Seattle, and we had 16 hours to talk. And we came up with, what could we do? And after talking for a very long time, water was a big issue, because where we live, it's so beautiful, and water plays a big part of it. And through the process, it was much more than I thought possible, because all the people we interviewed were scientists and experts in their field. And to find out how fortunate we are to have such a clean watershed, and ultimately to find out, yes, we are responsible for protecting this, because it's not this way all around the world. We're very fortunate.
And there are a lot of experts in this area and a lot of resources. And I know I've learned that there's more for me to learn about that.
Mm-hmm. So we can invite our listeners to go to our website, krfy.org, and hear the whole four-part series, because it really starts with the water. How do we get it? And where does it come from the National Weather Service, you know, the water cycle, to week two, where we, you know, looked at the glacial age floods that came down and really formed this. One of the things that really impressed me was the aquifer out at the Rathdrum Prairie, and how if that hadn't formed 15,000 years ago through the Ice Age process, through those big floods, there would not be a Spokane, Post Falls, and Coeur d'Alene, and probably not a Sandpoint, because we rely on those large population areas for so much, for our infrastructure, and how sensitive that aquifer is.
I was just going to say that what I learned was how connected we are. It might be underground, but the water in Lake Pendere is going into the Rathdrum Aquifer, and that we are one big community. We all need to take care of the water.
Yep, and it's very fragile, as the Ice Age guys said. And the third week, then, we looked at some of the regulations and regulatory agencies that look at different things, water use and some of the water protections. And then this last part of the series, we looked at our responsibility of protecting and some of the other organizations that are working on that. And I was really impressed with Tri-State, because that came out of the Clean Water Act, as she said. And
they did a lot of work, and those things are still in place. And as citizens being aware of that, then I think we're more informed in supporting our government, making good decisions about who's in charge.
And as Diane Williams said in that last interview, working with a diverse group of people with one objective in mind, keeping the watersheds in this area clean, healthy, and usable. So bravo to everyone who contributed by interviewing with us.
And as a community radio station, I would like to invite our listeners and other volunteers at KRFY that if you have ideas about this kind of series in the future, please let us know because we're looking.